at Cleveland Hopkins Airport. And we've been with him fairly constantly ever since. He's truly a gentleman in every sense of the word. A very, very ardent AA member. And as you will hear, he has a message of importance to all of us. I've heard his tape, and he is, I don't want to build you up too much, Johnny, but he is powerful. So without further ado, I would like to present our honored speaker of the morning, Mr. Johnny Harris, Lakewood, California.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very glad to be here. Sober. Fully clothed and in my right mind. Now, that might not make a lot of sense to a lot of people. But every time I get ready to do something like this, I like to reflect back to what it was like almost 18 years ago. You see, 18 years ago, give or take a month or two, I was crawling around on my hands and knees in a cell in solitary confinement in the maximum security penitentiary. And because the loving God has expressed himself through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, this morning it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around on my hands and knees like an animal. And to that extreme degree, I would like to be able to tell you this morning what it means for me to be here. But I don't think I'm capable of that, because how do you talk about some place that you use the most sacred place in the face of God's green earth? Because to me, this is where it all started, and this is what it's all about. When I go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, or I'm given the opportunity, the privilege to go somewhere and do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, I hope and pray to God that I will always continue what a stockbroker from New York did with a doctor in Akron, Ohio, 41 years ago. They sit down, and I guess, and I hope and pray to God that the stockbroker told the doctor what he was like and what had happened to him and what he was trying to be like that day. And I kind of like another little selfish thing back there, because long about that time I was getting awful confused about life, because I didn't understand it. And I kind of like to think that maybe God said to Bill on that morning a long time ago, you go down there and you talk to that doctor and you guys get this movement started, because we got a kid in Kansas that's going to need this thing in 24 years. And isn't it amazing, what one man said to another man, and how it reached across the country all the way over and got us into a little mountain resort in the penitentiary and found a dinghy like me sitting there waiting here. If I may this morning, I'd like to tell you a little bit about what I was like and what happened to me and what I'm trying to be like today. Because I don't know of anything else to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I don't really know whether I was born an alcoholic or not. I was born weird, and it got worse. I was kind of confused all my life because I didn't understand what was going on. You know, I thought I had a lot of high hopes and ideas and dreams and aspirations about how life is supposed to be, you know, somewhere over the rainbow and all that kind of stuff. And then I looked out and saw what it was really like. And it confused me. I saw a very average family. I saw a drunken mother, a drunken father, four drunken uncles, three drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. And I'd like to stand here and tell you that's the reason I'm an alcoholic. I like to be able to blame it on something. But that's not it. I didn't start out to be an alcoholic. I was very confused because I didn't understand what was going on. I never felt like I belonged to these people. I always felt that I was different than they were. I always felt that I was better than they were. I always felt that somewhere along the line I'm going to show up and find out where I belong. And I could understand. I looked at this filth that I call my family and this scum that I look down on in my spiritual snobbery, and I said, I'm better than they are, and I'm going to find that place where I belong someday. And so I looked around and tried to figure out somebody who had something that these other people didn't have. I looked at my older brother, and he didn't have nothing. And I looked at my little brother, and he didn't have nothing. And I looked over, and there was my grandmother. My grandmother, was a very wonderful lady. She lived till she was almost 90 years old, and she never took a drink of alcohol in her life. She prayed a great deal, Grandma did. And I found out that Grandma was the glue that kept the family together. But Grandma used to go to church on Sunday. And I used to say to myself, well, wherever Grandma goes, I'm going to go. Because whatever Grandma's got, I want. Because I don't want what they got, I want what Grandma's got. And so on Sunday, Grandma used to take me off to church. And like all little kids going someplace, I went with great hopes and anticipation and aspiration that that's the place in life that I'm going to belong. I'm going to sit down in the comfort of the Spirit's going to come about me, and I'm going to be at peace, and I'm not going to be scared, and I'm not going to be guilty about being scared, and I'm not going to be apart from everything, and everything's going to be fine. And I sit down in the church with great hopes and anticipation. And the man who's the epitome of authority would stand at the podium of the church and say, you're supposed to love and honor and respect your parents. He'd say you're supposed to love your brothers and your sisters. And I didn't. I hated them. I hated them for reasons I didn't even understand. And God, I felt guilty about that. And I became frightened to death sitting in that church and people were going to find out I was hating when I was supposed to be loving. I didn't know what to do about that. So I just sit there and said to myself, my God, I don't even belong here. Wonder what's wrong with me. I'm some kind of weirdo. And I turn around and walk outside of the church, and my mother and father would be sitting there drunk and hungover, and the old man would reach out and pat me on the head, and he'd say, son, if you continue to go to church, you're going to grow up to be just like me. If there was anything I didn't want to be, it was my old man. Because I hated him. My old man was the epitome of weakness, and I hated weakness. And you see, I had a perfect excuse why my old man was weak. It was alcohol. And I said to myself, I'm never going to drink. I'm never going to be like that bum. I'm going to be better. I'm going to rise above. I'm not going to be like my uncles and my aunts and my grandfather. I'm going to rise above all this stuff. You see, because I knew what alcohol did. I saw the results of alcohol. I saw the penitentiary. I saw the places my aunts worked in. I saw my own home. I lived in a home of two practicing alcoholics, and any child who lives in a home of two practicing alcoholics will tell you there's no other place in the world like the home and the nighttime in the home of the child of two practicing alcoholics. Of the screams of terror that break out in the middle of the night and the breaking furniture and the flesh hitting flesh and the broken glass and the screams, oh my God, and you lay there in stark terror and wonder when your turn is coming because you know he's coming to get you next. And that's the kind of thing to live with when I was a kid, and I said, I'm never going to drink. Because I'm going to be better than that. I'm going to rise above all that thing. I'm going to be better than my old man. But there I sit, you see, and I was frightened, and I was confused, and I was lonely, and I didn't belong anywhere, and I didn't know what was going on. I felt like I was going to blow up inside. And one day I got into my old man's bootleg pooch and took a drink of alcohol. And it was the most fantastic thing that ever happened to me in my life. It went down inside of me, and it blew the madness from inside of me. It took me from over there and it put me right there. The best way I can ever explain to you my first drink of alcohol was that alcohol put me together. It would seem to be the missing ingredient in this thing called life. And before I ever drank alcohol, I was like a little kid sitting on the outside looking on the inside of a big lighted room where all the wonderful, wonderful things were happening. And I'd say to myself, God, if I could just get in there where they were. If I could just move out of the darkness into the sunshine of the Spirit, everything would be fine. I took a drink of alcohol, and alcohol didn't take me out of the darkness and bring me into the Spirit. It took me out of the darkness and stood me up to the gray fringes of the business of living. And it installed in me a sense of arrogance that said, damn them who wants to be in there with them anyhow. It's all right right here. I was so unworthy and so useless in life, I figured I could never have what they had, but I'll settle for this. And you know what, folks? That was the story of my life. All my life, before I wandered into a crowd of a bunch of people like you, 16 and a half years ago. All my life, I always sold out for whatever was available. I never took what was my rightful inheritance in this thing called life. And I like to tell you that during the next 20 years of my life, I discovered some fantastic, successful way to drink. I never learned how to drink good. I was a hog from the beginning. And I was a hog when I quit. And in between time, there was a lot of madness. I took a drink of alcohol, and 3 days later, they pulled me out from underneath the bridge and sent me to the Hutchinson State Reform School. I was in that school a little while, and there was a knock on the door one day, and my mother showed up with a piece of paper and said she'd been given permission to take me out of the state of Kansas and bring me to take me to California. We left Kansas on our way to California one day, my mother, my older brother, my younger brother, and I. On our way to California, my mother said, "Kids, when we get to California, things are going to be different." And I don't know what my brothers thought. I thought, man, it's got to be different. There it is over there. You know, I lived over there with that idea that if I could just put it together out there, then this thing wouldn't be so bad. Then I wouldn't be so scared or so confused. I wouldn't have to smile at people that didn't want to smile at. I wouldn't have to say things they wanted me to say. I wouldn't have to be all them kind of things. If I could just get this, if I could just get a White House with a picket fence, if my mother could just have that crispy apron and a tray full of cookies and milk, if I could just bring my friends into the house and say, "This is my mom, I'm proud of her." But you see, my mother could never be like that, because my mother was afflicted with an illness that I didn't understand. And because I didn't understand it, I hated it. Anything that I didn't understand, I automatically hated it, because it was easier to hate it than to try to understand it. So we left our one-room shack in Kansas, and we went to California and got us a one-room shack with a bathroom. My mother introduced me to a couple new uncles. And I went out on the streetcar and got drunk. And I made a fantastic discovery. I found out that alcohol would do the same thing to me in California that it did in Kansas. And in my way of thinking, it was the only thing that I'd ever found that ever did the same thing twice in succession. You see, I was tired of people telling me things they weren't going to do. I was tired of getting my hopes and dreams and aspirations that high off the ground and have somebody kick the stool out from underneath. But I made a fantastic discovery. I found out that if I threw a brick through a window and got a bottle of Marco Petri red wine and drank it, it always did exactly what I anticipated it doing. It went down inside of me, and it moved me out of the blackness and stood me under the gray fringes of business and living. Then I got drunk and went to juvenile hall. And I was in juvenile hall a couple of weeks, and my mother came to visit me. She said a very strange thing to me. She said, "I love you and I miss you, and when you come home, things are going to be different." And I thought about that. But I wasn't buying it, because I'd already started to build the walls. And the dreams were getting further apart, and the illusions and the hopelessness and that aspiration was gone further and further down the road. So a couple of weeks later, we went in front of a judge, and he sent me to the Whittier State Reform School, and my mother stood up with a lawyer and appealed it. And I thought about that. A couple of weeks later, she came to visit me. She said, "I love you and I miss you, and when you come home, things are going to be different." I thought about that. 3.5 years later, we're still going to court. My mother, her lawyer, the judge, and I. The judge is sentencing, and old mom's appealing. My gang had been in and out 2 or 3 times. They hadn't even got started yet. And I had some kind of resentment about that, I guess. But it was all right. It became okay because I became obsessed with an idea. And I don't know what you know many things about, but I'm an authority on obsession. I've lived with them all my life. And obsessions with me are little strange things that happen. You know, they're little thoughts that pass through, you know, like a streaker in the dark. You know, it's just, "God, that was good going through there. I wonder what it was." And here it comes back again. You know, and first thing you know, there it sits. And, you know, I'm very grateful to Bill and Bob for many, many things. But one of the most gratifying things in my life is the knowledge of the terminology that they gave our illness. They call it an obsession of the mind coupled with an allergy of the body. And I love that obsession part of it because it drives the experts crazy. Yeah. You see, there isn't any way medically, clinically, or psychiatrically to treat an obsession. God has to remove them. The next thing that drives everybody crazy when they try to deal with an alcoholic. They never give them the missing ingredients, the thing called life. They never do that. I became obsessed with this idea that my mother, when I got home, was going to be okay. I went in front of the judge one day, and he said, they're going to put me in a boys' home in San Fernando Valley. So I got out to that school. When I got to the superintendent, said, if you're a good kid, we're going to let you go home on a home trip in 30 days. I said, I was good. 30 days came and went. They loaded us on an old truck, and they brought us out of the valley. It was an all-day trip. And the excitement and anticipation was mounting all about me. God, everything I've lived for all my life is going to be happening down there. I got off that truck and I ran a few blocks to catch an old subway car to ride downtown Los Angeles. I run to catch a few more blocks to catch an old red car to ride out to Willowbrook where I lived. I run a mile and a half from my mother's home. With excitement and anticipation about me that an only 11 or 12 year old kid had when he'd been away from home for a long time. This is it. This is the thing I've lived for all my life. It's going to happen now. I can pick it up and go on about my business. Around the corner, down the street, under the back door of my mother's house, there was a drunken party going on there. Nothing had changed. Except me. I spent 3.5 years in juvenile hall. I heard a lot of strange things. I heard things like everybody's a liar and everybody's a cheat. Never believed anybody that used to tell me because that's a sign of weakness. Never show anybody that you care for them that used to tell me because that's a sign of weakness. And more important than anything else, never reach your hand up out of the gutter because the minute you do that, somebody come along and kicks you in the teeth. Now, I didn't want to believe it. Because there was a thing way down deep inside of me that said, no, 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 that's not true. But I walked out of my mother's house that day and made a vow to myself, if I lived to be 500 years old, I'd never show anybody any human emotions again as long as I lived. I went on the street corner and I got drunk. I went back to school and I come home next month and I got drunk again. And along about that time in my life, I was a periodic. That's the only time I can remember being a periodic. And they don't let me out once a month, so I only got drunk once a month. It is always the same thing. I don't know how you are, but periodics are all the same breed of cats. You know, I'd come out, I'd get smashed, and I'd go back to school. And my first week in school was all right because I was a scholar. I read inspirational books. My second week in school was all right because I was an athlete. I took strenuous exercise. But my third week was when the madness set in because I started to think. And that's dangerous, you know, for an alcoholic. Somebody once told me an alcoholic ought to do one thing, drink or think, but he ought to not combine the two things. Because it's dangerous. That's a sign I can't stand in the AA clubhouse. Think, think, think. Boy, that's like lighting a fuse to the atomic bomb for a guy like me, you know. There's a gal in our area one time who just thought her mind was out to get her, you know. I buy that, you know. But I used to lay up in there, and I get this third week, and I'm getting ready to go home in a couple of weeks, so I start to think. I start to think about showing up down there in the neighborhood. I keep thinking about standing down there on the street corner, and the gang come up to me and wanting me to be the leader of the gang. I don't want to be the leader of the gang. I keep saying to myself, I wonder what the guys would say if I had to tell them, I don't want to go out and hit people in the head tonight. I want to go play baseball. I wonder what the gang would say to me if I had to tell them, I don't want to be a gangster. I want to be a doctor, or a lawyer, or an architect, or an engineer. I wonder what they would say. To see if you're like me, and you're a black blob of nothingness, and you're flatted out there in the world, and you're trying to figure out what is it that brings you out there and stands you into the gray fringes of the business of living, and gives you that ability to stand there and say, here I am. And the answer comes. It's a bottle of Marco Petri red wine. And one day I sit down in the street corner to drink my wine, and I drank the whole gallon of it, and I'm sober as I am right now. Scared to death because my magic's not magic anymore. And I don't know what to do about it. And a guy comes along and taps me on the shoulder and said, try these. And he gave me some pills. I found out that if I ate pills and drank wine, I could make the madness go away for a little while. It wasn't very much longer after that, sitting on the same street corner with a sack of pills and a gallon of wine, nothing's working. And a guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, try this. And he gave me some morphine. I found out if I put morphine in my arms and swallowed pills and drank wine, that it had a combination of things sustained me for the next 14 years of my life. It was never one, it was never two, it was a combination of everything. I became too old to stay in that school, so I came out of my neighborhood to become a gangster. That was my ambition in life. I wanted to be the Irish Lucky Luciano of Willowbrook. But I had a problem. I didn't stand up too often. And that's not conducive for being a gangster. You think I look alert when you're out there doing anything, you know. They just can't run and say, stick them up and throw up on people. Long dream. Oh, God. The whole idea of behind being cool is to be cool. You know, how cool are you? You know, when you're standing here trying to be tough and you're talking to the tough guy. And the tough guys always talk to tough guys. No, tough guys don't talk to nobody, they're tough. And when you're sitting here, you say, what'd you do last night? Big man say, well, I went over there to rob Charlie, but I puked on him. You know, it just don't work. It just doesn't have the ring of toughness about it, you know, that you got to have when you're out there in that world maintaining them images a lot. You know, everybody got that image you've got to maintain, you know, whatever it may be, you know. Whether you're a doctor, a lawyer, an Indian chief, you got to play that role. And what do? If you play that role, you really don't believe it. You see? Well, you got to fake it. And if you fake it long enough, pretty soon you can get what you're faking. And then you're really in trouble. That's the way I always was. I was not having too much luck as the Lone Ranger. So I thought I'd join a gang. And I went up to the gang. I had a reputation for being a tough kid. You know, that's really cool to be a tough kid in the neighborhood. You know, you got to have that reputation for being tough. And I found out that the tough ones are always the scaredest. The more frightened you are, the more tough you got to act. Because God, if they find out how scared you are, they don't think you're tough. Then it gets very confusing in there. You got to turn all your fears into hostilities and violence and stuff like that so people think you're king. So I went to join the gang. And I had a reputation, so they let me go out to do some gangstering with them. Me and the gangsters went out to do a deal, and I was going to be the lookout. And they come out from doing their deal, and I was getting arrested for being asleep on the curb. That blew my gangstering career. And the best way I can explain me to you before I found you was to tell you what I was. I was a never was. And if you don't know what a never was, a never was is something that's so frightened of failing, he doesn't try to do anything. He just sits back and says to himself, tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to get up off this floor, out of this jail, out of this house, out of this nut house, and I'm going to step out in that world, I'm going to fulfill all that great potential I've always been told that I've had. Tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to step out in that world and be the one thing in my family that somebody's proud of. Tomorrow. But then it took another drink, and I blocked off into oblivion. And I woke up the next morning sick, and I had to start it all over again, and I went on and on and on. The only thing that broke up was when I got arrested. I got arrested again, and my mother got me sentenced to the United States Army. My mother was always at my rescue. I guess she was trying to keep me from putting the mark on the family's good name or something. I haven't figured out what Mom's deal was, but my introduction to the United States Army, I was taken out of the Los Angeles County Jail in handcuffs and given to the provost marshal in Fort MacArthur, and he was told I enlisted. Well, that's not a good start, and the finish wasn't much better. You know, but they got tired of me in there, too, and I didn't come out eligible for the GI Bill, I'll let you know that. But anyhow, I came back and resumed my gangster career. And this time I did a little better, and got arrested a lot and fell down a lot and stood up a lot and threw up a lot. And nothing very much happened to me until 1951. Because I was a big man in 1951. Big man. Very big. Had a closet full of suits. Had a big automobile. Had a pocket full of money. Had a great big apartment building. Had all them things that were really important in life. I was a big man. The only thing that's wrong is the big man was so frightened he couldn't leave his apartment building till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Then the big man would pull down one of his big suits and put it on. He'd get down the back stairs of his apartment and he'd sneak into his big car and he'd drive up and down the street with the people who were coming home from work. And he'd say to himself, he had nobody else around to impress with his brilliance, so he would say to himself, I wonder what's wrong with me. Wonder why I'm different than that guy over there. I wonder why I can't be like my older brother. Wonder why I just can't go home and work and do all the things my older brother does. And then if you're like me, you see, you've got a ready-made excuse, a perfect whipping post. It's God's fault. It's always God's fault. My grandmother told me about a God who punished those boys who were bad. So I just figured that I was born in this favor. And so it stayed that way. So any time I had something that I didn't know how to put the handle on, it's God's fault. Now, I never said, help me, God. I just said, damn you. It's your fault. I never prayed to God because he didn't like me in the first place. And he didn't like me, I didn't like him either. Finally, I end up in the Los Angeles County Jail, the big man. And my mother came to visit me, and she stood on the other side of the visiting screen, and she screamed at me through the visiting screen that I was a murderer. It seemed that my baby brother had gotten into some of my poison and taken an overdose of it and died. And I didn't know how to handle it very well, because my baby brother was the only thing in life that meant anything to me. I was going to make sure that he didn't turn out like I did. 3 days later, I stood out underneath a tree, handcuffed between two detectives while they buried my baby brother. And I had all the guilt and shame and humiliation and degradation of a lifetime hanging on my shoulders. And I wanted to cry, and I didn't know how. I didn't have the simple gift of tears that God gives every creature that's born on the face of this earth. The reason I didn't have it, because I didn't think it was necessary. I went on to the penitentiary, and I stayed there almost 5 years. I came out of there 5 years sicker than I was when I went in. I spent the next 2.5 or 3 years of my life trying to prove what a psychiatrist in San Quentin told me wasn't true. He said, "Johnny, people like you won't change." He said, "You're doomed to die in an institution." He took me down and showed me the little green room. He says, "You're even going to end up here." And I gave him my stock answer and trade. Not me. I'm different. I wandered out of that institution bound and determined. I had that deal beaten. 6 months later, I was laying in a nut house kicking and screaming. And then I started making my rounds to some of the better laughing academies in the world, interviewing psychiatrists. I'm a psychiatrist interviewer when I'm not doing anything else. It usually always went out the same way. I had my wraparound overcoat on. They had their glasses down here, and the conversations always went the same. They would talk about my mother, I talked about their mother, and they threw me out of the room. We never seemed to get on a common ground, these guys. Yeah? One of the reasons that I never did get along with psychiatry, and I don't today, is because they were always talking about something that didn't make any sense to me. You see, they were always talking about something that made no sense. You know what they used to tell me? They used to tell me, "Johnny, if you didn't drink these things, swallow these things, and smoke these things, and shoot these things, you wouldn't have any problems." That wasn't my problem. You see, my problem was that I had a hole in my gut. And I was frightened to death, and I didn't know what to do about it. And I was guilty about being frightened, and I didn't belong anywhere, and I felt like I was going to explode inside all the time, and I wanted to just tell people that. But I didn't know how. And I never found anybody that was kind enough who would sit and listen and say to me, "I understand." So when they told me that the things that filled up the hole and removed the fear and the guilt and the loneliness and remorse from me, when they told me the things that washed those things away from me were my problems, they had to be automatically crazy. They weren't my problem. They were the answer to my problem. 18.5 years ago, they laid me down on a bed in the Los Angeles County Jail and told me I was going to die before morning. I weighed 128 pounds and I was yellow. I had my left arm and my right leg tied down. And a medical doctor stood at the foot of my bed and he said, "Son, you're going to die before morning. There's nothing I can do for you." And I said, "Okay." And he left, and all day passed and all night passed. He'd come back in my room the next morning and he stood there and he said the same thing. And I said, "Okay." The third day came around, and the doctor started to come back in my room. I had a terror grip me that I've never known before since in my entire lifetime. And the idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. I was going to get up out of that bed and go to the penitentiary and come back out and start that rat race all over again. And God knows I didn't want to do that. But I didn't want to die either, because I felt cheated. Now, I don't know what you thought about in your moments of sanity and your practicing alcoholism, but I used to have a little secret thing that I could never tell anybody because it was so silly. But I used to have a little secret thought in the back of my mind that I would just like to spend a day of my life out there wandering around in the world like everybody else. I would just like to become a blade of grass in the lawn of life out there. That's what I wanted to be. I didn't want to be a flower in the lawn or a brown spot in the lawn. I just wanted to be a blade of grass. I just wanted to walk through life one day of my life without being noticed by everybody. And when I thought I was going to die, and I wasn't going to be given that opportunity, I felt cheated. And so I blamed my whipping post. I blamed God. There you are again. Damn you. I laid like that for 18 days and 18 nights. I didn't eat, sleep, drink, or do anything. Just laid there. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, and don't ask me where it came from, because I don't know, but somewhere way down deep in the very recesses of my soul, I screamed out a prayer, "Oh God, help me." And I thought for a long, long time that nothing happened, but that's not true. Something happened. I went to sleep for a little while that night. And from that day to this very day, my life has been different. Now, there was no blinding flash of light. Nobody come running through the room with a dozen donuts saying, "We got an amen down the hall." I wasn't suddenly spectacularly upheaved by the fifth chapter on the wall. Nothing that like that happened. The only thing that happened to me is that I got up out of that bed and I went on, and the first thing I recollect happened to me was I was standing in front of a Superior Court judge in Los Angeles County. And he was talking, not to me, but to a woman who was sitting in the room. There was a woman sitting in there who was pregnant with a child. Do you know what he told her? He said, "Lady, if you have any kind of concern for the child you carry inside of you, you get so far away from this scum that you'll never allow a child to lay eyes on him, because he isn't fit to be in society or around anybody that's human. He's an animal. He's a blood-sucking parasite on society, so do yourself a favor, check him off." And I'm standing there, and I said, "I wonder who he's talking about. He can't be talking about me, because this ain't the way it started out to be. You see, that's lower than my old man, and I better than him. That's not like, that's my dad, that's not me." But I shuffle off. The next thing I heard him say, "I sentence you to 20 years in the maximum security penitentiary." So I wandered off. I went into the penitentiary, and things were not the same in the penitentiary. And things were not the same because I just didn't have it anymore. I just wasn't nickel slick and double keen and dollar cool anymore. I just didn't want to be big time Willie the Wolf and a mountain hound. Willie the Wolf had become a whipped dog. That's what Willie the Wolf had become. And I didn't know what to do about it. So I did the only thing I knew how to do. I retaliated. I turned violent and had to be locked up in a maximum security penitentiary in solitary confinement for the next 9 months of my life, because I became an animal. And finally they came in there and they transferred me to a place in the southern part of the state, a compulsory rehabilitation center called Tehachapi. For 16 and a half years ago on a Sunday morning, I ran into you. Now, if I'd have known where I was coming to 16 and a half years ago on a Sunday morning, I wouldn't have come. That's how simple it is. Because I wasn't an alcoholic when I came here. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I just weird and didn't belong anywhere. And scared and frightened and confused and hostile and everything in the world. I'll tell you what brought me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. They brought some women into the institution. So I came here to smell perfume. And I've been here ever since. You ought to see me hitting, sniffing and honking around in here. I've been honking and sniffing around here all weekend. And gee, you smell good. And if you guys can't appreciate that, you ain't ever slept some of the places I slept. But anyhow, I wandered into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with my coat collar up and my shades on. Because that's cool. And I sat in the back row, and I looked up on the backboard, and I saw two big A's, and I thought to myself, "My God, I wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade." And I nudged this clown next to me. I said, "What is this?" He says, "It's Alcoholics Anonymous." I saw him down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be in there with them winos. If it had been Gangsters Anonymous, I'd have been there. Yay! Charlie Brown and all that kind of stuff. So I thought, well, I sit around waiting for them women to tell their racist stories. So I got up in this room with Kurt. So they stood there with a twinkle in their eye and a smile on their face, and they radiated a certain something that I didn't understand. And right away they ruined it because they started talking to me about God. And I got up and ran out of the room. When you came to me and I heard about this God of that, it wasn't that I didn't believe in him. I believed in him. Or I didn't believe he hated me. He hated me, I hated him back. But I kept coming back to your meetings because it's seeing you and seeing you and seeing me. And I didn't know what I was looking at. I didn't hear the word sobriety or not drinking. I just saw the people. I saw the twinkles in their eyes and the smiles on their face, this thing that they radiated. So I kept coming back to their meeting. And they kept talking about God, and I kept leaving. And every once in a while, I'd wander through the yard of this institution, and I'd grab one of these convicts and put him up against the wall and look in his eyes and shake my head and say, "You ain't got it. Turn around and walk off." I heard one of them say, Jesus, Johnny's been here too long. Really risen it. You know, and I'm one of the type of guys, when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't want anybody to know I was going to the meetings. And that's kind of hard when you're in a place with only 500 of you there and you eat and sleep together. You only got one place and they announced over the public address speaker, Alcoholics Anonymous is meeting in the dining room. You know, and everybody goes in there, they go, one of them winos. You know. So when you're cool, and you don't want anybody to know that you're going to Alcoholics Anonymous, you do this. You stand outside the door looking nonchalant until you hear the guy say, we'll say the serenity prayer. Then while everybody's praying, you're ready to sit down. And you look nonchalant, and you mimic, and you ridicule, and you nudge the guy next to you and say, oh, do you believe that crap? Look at that phony in the front row. And then just about the time they say, we're going to say the Lord's Prayer, you scoot outside and you stand there and get cool again. So you can tell the guy that the only reason you're lined up there is to see the women walk out of the room. And all the time inside, you're dying inside because you think to yourself, that's a wonderful organization, but I can't belong to it because I'm not like them. I'm different than they are. I've gone too far down the road. They're not like me. Look at them. Listen to them. Gee, they wish I could have it. But you kept going to meetings. One day they brought a guy in and he stood in the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous on a Sunday morning a long, long time ago and he said something to me I've never forgotten. It makes more sense to me than anything that I know. It'll make more sense to me tomorrow than anything that I know today. He said to me where I was sitting, he looked down at me, this guy had done 23 flat years in the penitentiary and I knew him. He looked down where I was sitting and he said to me, you don't have to live this way no more if you don't want to. You just don't have to do it like this no more. God, nobody had ever told me that. People had been telling me all my life that I had not to drink these things, swallow these things, smoke these things, and shoot these things. But nobody ever said to me, you don't have to live like this no more. After the meeting, I went up to this guy and I said, how do you learn how to live? And he smiled at me. He said, Johnny, there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous over in the library. If you go get that book, I'll go home and pray that you find some part of you in that book. And I guess he prayed real hard, that guy, because I've been a student of the book Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this day, and I have never found anything in that book but me. I have found me on every page, every paragraph, every sentence, everything that I've ever read in that book, I find me. And I got active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And boy, was I a card. I tell you, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't have had me with a large dowry. Because I did everything backwards. But it goes to prove to you, you know, a guy like me, one thing that I wasn't doing wrong, I wasn't swallowing nothing of a chemical nature. And I used to hear things like, you got to get active. So I looked around and we had one of them smiling secretaries in our group. He stayed in the guy. Wonderful, we're living in wonderful. So I went up to him, I said, of course there's nobody around. Oh, what do you want to do? You don't just leap into this thing all at once, you know. You got to prepare yourself to get into Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, what do you want to do? I said, yeah, I don't know. He says, why don't you go greet the guest on Sunday? That doesn't take much sense. That hurt me. Then I said, out of defiance, just to prove to him that I was different. Okay. He said, you do it Sunday. I said, no, I won't. You do it Sunday, I'll watch you and find out how you do it. Now, you know, we don't just do things automatically. We got to know what we're doing. Who's going to make a mistake? Jesus, you make a mistake, the world will fall apart. Then everybody would say, haw. I spent all my life not to get haw. I just didn't want to make mistakes. So I watched him Sunday. I went over there and stood very nonchalantly and watched him. He wandered, welcomed Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a wonderful way to live. Come join our happy program. They followed him in there. He poured their coffee, emptied their coffee, smiled at him. It was very wonderful. But he did it wrong. I'm going to show him how cool dude from the neighborhood does it. Nonchalantly, so nobody knows you've joined Alcoholics Anonymous. You saunter down there with your frown. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a wonderful way to live. Come join our happy program. They wouldn't come in. And there you stand. And I said to my friend, what's the matter? He says, dummy, you got to smile at him. I said, what's that? He said, the frown turned upside down. They teach you all kinds of things around here. If you're new, just stick around. They'll teach you how funny things about dumb little sayings like the frown. Who knows how smart some of these guys are? My sponsor's a smart ass, too. You know what I mean? Anyhow, it wasn't very long before I became the phony of the group. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a wonderful way to live. Come join our happy program. I took them in and set them down at the meeting. I poured their coffee and emptied their coffee and smiled at them. Then I went back in the corner and died. Because I still had the terror about me. I was still full of the great fear in life that I'd gone so far I couldn't have this thing. I still had the great knowledge about me that I was different than these other people. I still had the great knowledge about me because I was doing everything they told me to do and I was still frightened to death. I was still guilty and I was still full of remorse and guilt and loneliness and I didn't belong. I didn't know what to do about it. And I would read their book and nothing would happen. And I would read their book and nothing would happen. And then things started to happen. I'd get ready to go to the parole board. And they told me, yeah, you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, people recognize the change in you. Yeah, man, everything's wonderful. You walk through the golden arches and happiness and blah, blah, blah. Geez, I'm about that high off the ground. 2 days before, I went in front of the parole board and they gave me from a letter from a woman that said she's divorcing me and I'm never going to be allowed to see her and child again. Then I went in front of the parole board and they told me I couldn't go home. So Sunday, I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting to resign from Alcoholics Anonymous for my first time. I was going to do it in a flourish. I was going to stand at the podium and denounce you for what you really were. But I never got to the podium. Because I sat in the front row of a meeting and I held an old lady's hand by the name of Myrtle Snyder. And she told me over and over and over again, honey, there has to be a reason for everything that happens to you in this lifetime. And what she told me wasn't really important, what I felt. See, I sat in that room for 2 hours of my life on a Sunday morning and I held that old lady's hand and I didn't hurt anymore. I wasn't bewildered and frightened and confused and lonely. I felt a small part of something for the first time in my life. I felt that somebody in this world really cared about what happened for me. And so I followed her out of that room and I wandered down after her and held onto her hand because I knew that the moment I let go of this thing, I was going to lose this magic. And I looked at her when she got ready to leave and I said, Jean Bert, what was this thing you tried to give me? And she had the most beautiful, sparkling blue eyes you'd ever seen. And she looked at me and she smiled and she said, sweetheart, the answer to any question you may ever have in your lifetime lies between the covers of a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And she left. So I went to that book to find this thing that I lost. And I read it from cover to cover and upside down and inside out and nothing happened. And I threw it across the room and screamed out in my despair, my God, I'm different. Like, I can't have this thing. One day I looked down and saw the most simple statement that I'd ever seen in my life. It said, how it works. I want you to know I almost missed that. And that's not because I know any great thing. It's just because, you see, I've had the opportunity to live sober in the world for over 16 and a half years. Without any type of a chemical additive in my system to make life just a little better. I have, from time to time, great anxiety attacks. And my doctor doesn't prescribe Valium for it. You see? The thing that's removed my anxiety attack is a working formula called Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's outlined in a book. Because I had to do those things. And don't ask me why I did them, because I don't know. I did them because I had no other choice in the matter but to do them, because my life was in jeopardy and I knew it. I knew that I had run out the end of the string and I had to do something. And if this thing worked, I was going to try it. And so I started to attempt to put those steps to practice in my life on a daily basis in that institution. I found it necessary to write out an inventory. I found it necessary to sit down with a man and tell him about everything that I'd ever done. For 3.5 hours, I said eyeball to eyeball with a man and told him every rotten, filthy, corruptible thing I'd ever done in my life. And at the end of that 3.5 hours, I got to walk out of that man's room and I sit down underneath a tree and I choke back a tear, because one had ever felt like. And the great ball of madness has been lifted from me. To this very day, it's never returned. And fantastic things started to happen to me. People started to flow in and out of my life. The first one I'd like to call you about, the guy that I owe probably one of the greatest debts of my life to, was a little non-alcoholic dentist in this institution. Because this man loved me. He loved me a very great deal, I understand today. Because he loved me enough to tell the truth, to tell me the truth. And there's a vast difference between correction and corruption. Anybody can pat you on the back and tell you how wonderful you are, and that's good corruption for an egotist. But what about the guy that puts his arm around your shoulder and wanders you off in the corner and say, what's the matter? You got that funny look in the middle of your eye. You're not really showing up at the meetings with that spring in your step anymore. You're not really doing these things. You got a problem somewhere? You see, that's love. But a guy like me, an egotist, I got an audacity sometimes to walk up in my group where I'm the guru and see somebody who isn't doing what I think they ought to do. Let them have it. And then you turn and you say, I'm just telling them the truth. That's a bunch of crap. I'm just exploiting my own ego. Because if I really love somebody, I would do like they did with me. I would pull them off at the side, where it's just me and them, and I'd ask them, what's the matter? You don't seem to have a spring in your step no more. One day I'm a barber in this institution, and the dentist come in to get his haircut. And long about that time in my life, my vocabulary consisted of about four-letter words. And I used them all. I used them in different combinations and different strings of things, but they all were prefaced by mother. And so the dentist and I were in our conversation. And he said to me, Johnny, if you ever get out of here, but that didn't endear him to my heart right there. He said, what are you going to do? And I let him have it. You know, all forward, backwards, forward, round. He said, you'll never make it. I said, why not? He says, the minute you open your mouth, they're going to know where you come from. Now, this guy had to be the smartest or the dumbest man I ever met, because I had a razor in my hand. And he said, I said, what's the matter with my mouth? He said, nothing. You just open it every now and then. And then he said this to me. Do you know what cussing is? And I said, no, what? He said, it's a crutch for conversational cripples. And I looked at him and I was spellbound. And I said, what am I supposed to do about it? What am I supposed to do about it? I've always talked this way. I was taught to talk this way. I've talked this way all my life. What am I supposed to do about it? Is you really serious? And I said, yeah. He said, 3 or 4 of the businessmen in town and I have a little deal. We get together every Tuesday night over the mess hall. If you come over there, we'll teach you how to talk. I said, yeah, I bet you will. So on Tuesday night, I went in there and I sat down with the businessmen. And for the next period of my life, I don't know how long it was, word by word, paragraph by paragraph, sentence by sentence, these people fed me in the English language. They corrected me when I was wrong. When I said a wrong word, they said, you don't say it like that, you say it like this. And I used to get mad and throw things at them and throw temper tantrums at them and say, you don't understand. And they just smile and say, yes, we do. God, how much love can human beings bestow upon another human being? These people weren't members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Finally, one day, the little dentist sat in my chair and he said to me, Johnny, tonight you get to give the talk. I said, what do you mean I get to give the talk? He says, yeah. He says, you know, that guy last week talked and all that, and you're going to talk with the group tonight. But don't report finally. Not me. Yeah, I said, what am I going to talk about? And they talk about Captain Marvel. What do you want me to talk about? Superman or something? I don't know anything about none of that stuff. And he said, that program you go to called Alcoholics Anonymous, what do they do? Because that's very simple. They just tell you what it's like and what happened, what it's like today. And he said, try that. That night I went over to the place where the little people were, and I sat down and I told them what I was like and what happened to me and what I'm trying to be like that day, and they gave me a little statue. God, I love that statue. It's the only thing I'd ever got in my life that I hadn't stolen. And I took that little statue home and I put it up on my locker and I looked at my statue and I saw it when I went to bed. I saw it when I woke up in the morning and I took it to work with me and set it on my counter. And I loved my little statue. I became so impressed with my little statue that I worshipped my little statue and became my God. Then I went over there next Tuesday night and the cafe owner in town got up and gave a little talk and they gave me my statue. God, I hated him. I sit during that meeting and I try to figure out how I could get out of that meeting and get in a tree and leap on him and get my statue back before he got out of that institution. Then all week long, I laid up all night long trying to figure out how I could get out of that room, over the fence, run 10 miles of town, steal my statue, get back and over the fence and into my bed before they knew I was gone. I was obsessed with it. You know what I learned from that? I didn't learn it from that very long ago, but I learned a great lesson from that. I learned that anything that you can hold in the palm of your hand, or touch, or feel, or see, has no value in God's eyes. That the real values of God's kingdom for His children are things of the Spirit. They're the peace, and the happiness, and the joy, and the tranquility of knowing that no matter what comes down the road, everything is going to be okay. Those are the treasure chests in my Father's house. They're the working application of the 12 principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been privileged to tap that storehouse of treasures time and time and time again. 15 years ago this month, I walked out of that penitentiary. My mother fell off the steps blind drunk. I picked her up and put her on a couch and said, Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting. She said, fine, I think you should. It took my mother a long time to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm very proud to tell you this morning that when my mother sober, she's a member of our fellowship. I'm very proud. I'd also like to tell you that I didn't have anything to do with it. Because if I had something to do with it, I'd destroy her. I tried to get her sober. My first year sober, I worked on my mother. I sat down with my mother with all the literature. She sat down with a half a pint. And I said to my mother, you've got to get sober, Mom. And she said, why? That's a good question. If you got no answer. And you know, if you're like me and you're a dummy who just don't do anything to spout phrases, easy does it, first things first, live and let live. But for the grace of God, you got to get sober, Mom. Why? Well, you got to change your way of living. What's the matter with my way of living? She say, listen, Charlie. I say, Mom, my name's not Charlie. Quiet, Mike. Remember, it was me who come to visit you in the nut house. And if you ever have to come to visit me in the nut house, I'll join your program. And that's very frustrating. One day I had my mother down on the floor slapping her in the face with a sponsorship pamphlet.
Thank you.
And in my frustration, I left because she just wouldn't shape up. And I ran to a meeting where Myrtle was. And I ran over there because that's where I'm going to get some sympathy, because the world's not shaping up. And I ran up to Myrtle and I said, she looked at me, and I guess you can see that I was a basket case. She said, "What's the matter, sweetheart?" I said, "It's my mother." She said, "You poor soul. And you got it. You know what you got." And I smiled. She says, "I feel sorry for you." She says, "You know what? If somebody came to you today and needed the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you ain't got nothing to give. You've been so egotistically involved with trying to sober people up. Frustration for people who don't want this thing, that if somebody came and really needed this thing, you wouldn't have anything to give. And you want to remember one thing, son. You never want to deny anybody the privilege of suffering." It's a very wise statement. Because I left my mother alone. And I learned a great lesson from my mother in the last 15 years. I learned I don't have the power to get anybody sober. I don't have the power to get them drunk either. I don't even have any power of my own to keep me sober. I have no choice in that. I didn't start out to be sober. I just showed up and did what you told me. I don't know how you are, but my first 5 or 6 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was so successful. I became magnificent. Magnificent, I was. The epitome of wonderfulness. I had all the answers to the world. I showed up at the meetings in my new car, in my new suit with my pocket full of money. And I'd stand at the door, and people would say, "How are you doing?" I said, "I got my new car out there." "How are you doing, John? Did you see my new suit?" "Gee, John, is everything all right? Man, you want to see my money? Look at my credit cards. I'm just wonderful." And then I used to let them really have it. When it gets tough, you can always let them have this. "I ain't never had it so good." And then I left the meeting and I got in my car and I drove home to my house. I parked my car in the driveway and I went into an empty home. Then I had to start wandering up and down the neighborhood to find my children. Then I had to locate my children and put them in the car, and we had to start making rounds in the bar to find their mother. Then we'd go into the bar, me and the two kids, and we'd create scenes and we'd drag our wife out of there by the hair of the head from time to time. We'd put her in the car and we'd drive home, and I'd always ask her the same question. "Why? Why do you do this?" And the answer was always the same. "I just want to have fun." "You're no fun, John. All you do is work and go to those meetings. I just want to go have fun. If you would just go dancing. If you would just come out, you don't have to drink or go to those meetings. You just come and go dance with me." One night I came that close to home. That close. But a slap on it. And I got up the next morning and I went into where this woman was lying. And I said to her, "You know what, Nancy, I can't live this way any longer. Last night I almost committed suicide. I almost went with you, and I can't do that. I have to do what I'm doing because my very life depends upon it." And I went off to work, and an hour later she took her own life. Now, I don't understand things like that. I really don't. I even have a hard time accepting them. The next things that happened to me were things kept leaving me. All my props and my phoninesses of how wonderful I was doing was leaving. It's awful hard to stand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with your guts tearing up and you're 6 years sober and you're wonderful and you're living in a $60 a month rented room in East Long Beach. You're wearing on your back what you've got. You're working 14 hours a day and they just repossessed your car. You haven't got to say, "Look at my new car. Look at my nice suit." You got to just stand there and hate. So I got ready to resign from Alcoholics Anonymous my second time. And if you're a big phony like me, you do it wonderfully. You do it magnificently in a great air of expectations. You set the stage. So my sponsor was getting ready to speak at a Sunday night meeting in our town, and I went to where he was speaking to tell him that I was leaving. But I wasn't just going to tell him quietly. I was going to stand up in the middle of his talk and say, "So long, Norm. You really tried, but I just ain't got it. And then the people were going to get me and save me again. But I never got to because I was too scared to do that. I just sit in the meeting and listen to him. He talked about his wife and his children and his job and his home and all the things. And I sit there. And after the meeting, I went up to my sponsor to tell him. But I couldn't get to him because there was a crowd of people around him. So I started to leave and walk out the door. I don't know where I was going. But the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is that my sponsor saw me out of the corner of the eye, and he left a crowd of people and passed on his back to come give me a pat on my back. And he put his arms around me and he hugged me, my sponsor, and he said these things to me. He said, "Gee, Johnny, God must love you a great deal." And I said, "No, Norm, I don't feel like he loves me a great deal. Leave me alone." He says, "Yeah, Johnny, he never gives any of us any more than we can handle. And those who got the biggest load got to be the blessed." I said, "I don't feel like being blessed anymore, Norm. Please leave me alone." He kept following me. And finally he said this to me, "Remember, my friend, he gives the big crosses to the big hosses, and he gives the little crosses to the little hosses." So I went home that night and tried to figure out how big my cross was. And I didn't have one. Because I was sober. And I had been sober. And I had spent not one day out there as a blade of grass along with life. I had spent many days out there. Uncountless days. The big days have always outnumbered the bad days. I've had far more greater joy. As a matter of fact, it's the only joy I've ever known. Since I wandered into a program called Alcoholics Anonymous and started applying these principles to my everyday business of living. It's the only joy I've ever known. I haven't been restored anything. I've been given everything. I had nothing when I came here. I never was anything. I never lost anything. You can't lose anything if you never got nothing to lose. The thing that I never had and the thing that I lost and the thing that was gone from me is the thing that they sit down and I guess and I hope and pray to God that the stockbroker told the doctor. So the thing that was gone for me is the thing that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to do. It's designed for one particular purpose and one particular purpose only. It's designed to restore into people like me, people who never have had, who have lost their self-respect. It is designed to allow them to stand out there in that world and one day at a time through the working application of 12 simple principles in their life, they're allowed to be restored to it. Feeling of self-respect. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous does. It gives you your self-respect. It allows you the privilege to stand out there in that world every day in dignity and with self-respect. We got a little lady in our group. She's about a year sober, and I love this kid because to me she's a beautiful woman. She made one of the darndest statements in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've ever seen because she's a young, beautiful gal. I don't have to tell you what happens in some of the meetings with the young, pretty girl. You and I know. And this gal said, no, that ain't the way it's going to be. She stood in the meeting one day and she said, "I stand in dignity, but I've had to earn my self-respect." That's true. There isn't anything more dignified or beautiful, in my opinion, in the world than a sober lady alcoholic. Guys like me, we come and go, you know. Because there was a lady, an alcoholic, who was beautiful in stature and dignified in her appearance, who loved me back into this thing called life. And I never go anywhere that I don't take her with me. I never do anything that I don't have her with me. I never attempt to do anything I don't think of myself. I wonder what she would say. And one of the things that endears me to Akron and to Dr. Bob more than anybody else that I have ever known upon the face of this earth is something that he said a long time ago when somebody like me was trying to get into the meetings in the early days and they were afraid they were going to put a stigma on their fellowship. He smiled and very strongly and very sweetly, I'm sure, said, "What would the Master say?" That's what murder needs to tell me. My life today, I can't explain it to you because it's the thing you need. My children. My oldest daughter is 18 years old almost. And I almost lost that kid in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I've I'll make sure she's like me. And I browbeat her and talked down to her, mimicked her, and humiliated her in front of a friend. And one day I had to do what they tell us to do here. I had to sit across the table from my daughter and tell her, I'm sorry. I've been trying to create something out of you you may not want to be, but know this, that from this day forward, I'm just going to love you. You can go where you want to go, do what you want to do, and know this, that you can't do any good thing in life that's going to make me love you anymore. And you can't do enough bad things to make me love you any less. Just know that I love you. About a year ago, my oldest daughter and I were coming back from Southern California Alateen Conference. Santa Barbara and I talked at the bank at that time. And we spent time at the dance with Karen and I. We're coming down this long, lonely road, Santa Barbara, this ocean all over, this beautiful moonlit night, and my daughter isn't saying anything, and I'm not saying anything. It's about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I looked over at her and I said, sweetheart, did you enjoy yourself? And she broke down and she started to cry. She said, yes, I did, Danny. She said, I'm so proud of you. So all night long, she said, I'm sitting there and I said, that's my dad. And when the kids would come up to me and say, gee, Karen, there's your dad. She said, I felt so good. She said, I just want you to know that I love you and I'm so proud of you. And we broke down and we started crying. I don't know how you buy something like that. I don't know how you stand in front of 1,000 people or how many people there is and say thank you for that. I don't know how you stand here and say, geez, I'm full of gratitude that I can't see. I never thought I'd ever be able to even go near Akron, let alone stand there. I don't know how you say to people with my children, the way I feel about my children, the love inside of me, the joy and the peace and the happiness I got because of people like you. Because two guys sat down and thought this was a good idea, that they shared their soul with one another. That a guy like me could sit and cry on a highway out of Santa Barbara with a 17-year-old girl. And I don't know how to take the thing. Last night I called my youngest daughter, my 14-year-old. And she told me how to take it. My youngest daughter was born 14 years ago last April. A few years ago, I got up to go talk at a Sunday morning meeting. My daughter came running out of the bedroom and she said, where are you going, Daddy? And I said, I'm going to an AA meeting. She said, Daddy, it's my birthday. You'll miss my birthday party. And I said, I'm sorry. And she broke down and she started crying. She left, she ran back in where Daddy is. And I started to speak out the phone. About the time I got to the car door, full of guilt, shame, all the things that we know so well, because we pulled another boo-boo again. She come running out of the car, and she's crying, tears in her brown eyes. She threw her arms around me, and she said, Daddy, when you get to that meeting, will you do something for me? I said, I can. She said, will you thank the people of Alcoholics Anonymous for my dad? And I do. If it hadn't been for people like you, coming to see people like me, unsolicited, that little girl wouldn't even be here. And if she was here, I wouldn't be here to take care of her. So I thank you. I thank you for everything I have. I thank you for the way of healing inside, for the things that will be mine. And I'm sure that I thank you for all the beautiful days that I have in my life. I like to stand here and I like to thank God for our Alcoholics Anonymous. But more importantly than anything that I know of, I'd like to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for my God.